Revelation chapter 6. We're engaged in a study of Revelation, as you know. I have to admit there have been times, more than one time, when I've second-guessed my choice on this, but I'm pushing through. I've decided to endure. I'm familiar with words of Jesus who said, he who endures to the end will be saved, so that's what I'm looking at. But it's a good challenge to read this book and to try to bring something out of it that you can share in 20 or 25 minutes. And that's what I'm trying to do this morning. My article in The View was to have some background on Revelation 6 and 7. So if you didn't read that, then I'm going to be racing over some things today. But you can go back and check some of that. And kind of explains my reason for talking about that. What I'm going to talk about this morning from Revelation 6, the lesson that I've extracted from it is simply that there is adversity in the world. That's pretty obvious, and that's what this book is about. There's adversity in the world that then God will take care of someday. He'll cure it all. There is adversity in chapter 6. There's not much good news here. There's good news in chapter 7, but not in chapter 6. This is about the outpouring of adversarial things, usually by men who have cruel ends in mind. They want to control people. And then there's disease that enters in here too. So there's a lot of things going on. Let's read it before we talk about it. Starting in verse 1. It says, "Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say with a voice like thunder, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a white horse. And its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, 'Come.' And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another. And he was given a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a black horse. And its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, 'A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine.' When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of a fourth living creature say, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by wild beasts of the earth. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, 'O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?' Then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves had been. When he opened the sixth seal, I heard, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth, the full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll that is being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals and the rich and the powerful and everyone slave and free hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, 'Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?'" So, just a reminder, Jesus, the Lamb, took the seal, the scroll, from God, the Father, who's sitting on the throne. We see that in chapter 5. Now he's unfolding these seals. He's opening these seals one by one. We get six of them here. There are seven seals. There's going to be an interlude in chapter 7, and then we'll pick up the seventh seal in chapter 8, which then opens some other interesting things. But we're going to look at what is going on here, at least in my opinion, one by one, quickly. First, in the first four seals, we have the famous four horsemen of the apocalypse. I say famous because that's something that a lot of people have heard in the past, know about from some source. There was a movie in 1962 by this name, starring Glenn Ford and a couple others, famous actors. But in any case, these are the four horsemen. We're going to talk about them in more detail in a minute. In the fifth seal, when that's opened up, you see martyrs. So you get a view of martyrs who are under the altar of God, and they're crying out for justice. I don't think they're crying out for vengeance as such. They're crying out for justice. They've been killed by people who were killing Christians all over the place at this time, or maybe the emperors or their emissaries were doing that. And they, of course, want to see justice done. I don't think this has anything to do with the final day or when we're going to be in heaven or anything like that. I don't think he's just describing that at all. It's just a figurative way of saying that God cares about what is happening to these people who have lost their life for him. And then there's seal number six, and that is a cataclysmic judgment of some kind on the kings of the earth and great ones and generals and the rich and powerful and everyone slave and free. So the people who are responsible for all these adversities, all of this harm that's being done to other people, God is going to get justice on that, and that's what the sixth seal is about. So I want to talk a little bit about the four horsemen and look at that in a little more detail, because I think this is kind of the gist of what I want to get at this morning and talking about the reality of adversity. I don't think I have to convince you that adversity is real, that suffering is real, that trials are real. You've all suffered those. We know that happens to everyone. It's not particular about where it strikes. It's of various kinds, as we'll see in this. And so these four horsemen, I believe all four, are coming out to wreak havoc on the earth. And we're getting that picture. The white horse represents conquerors, people who go out, kings and others and generals, as he mentions in the end of chapter 6, who go out to conquer people and to control them, to have power over them. And we've seen a lot of people, I'll talk about that in a little bit, we've seen a lot of people who fall into that category. I don't believe it's Christ. I explained that in the view. I disagree with a couple of our brethren about that, but I don't believe this is picturing Jesus. There's a similar picture in chapter 19. There's a white horse there too, but it's much different. The crown that he's wearing, this particular rider is wearing, is the crown of victory, not the crown of a king, not a diadem. It's a Stephanos. And also, he has a bow in chapter 19. Jesus has a sword, and it's actually coming out of his mouth. He has flames of fire. There's a lot of differences here. So I think all of these four horses are doing the same category of thing, and that is they're wreaking havoc on the earth. That's my opinion. The bright red horse that you see up there, the bright red horse is the horse of war. So specifically, this is the rider who comes with a sword to take peace from the earth, it says. So again, we've seen a lot of this over time. A lot of people who want to just wage war for their own reasons. And I believe that's what that's talking about. Then you see a black horse. A black horse represents famine, a lack. We might think of the Great Depression in the 30s when there was a lack of food and people were standing in lines and things like that. That's what that represents. You say three quarts of barley for a denarius. The denarius was a day's wage. So he's selling a lot. He's selling a little for a lot is the idea there. And you might say, you know, a gallon of gas for a denarius today or something. You know, it seems to be headed that way. But that's the idea. There's just a big price for a little of something. And it's not, you notice that he's not, these people aren't hurting the filthy rich and the people who are already powerful, because they don't harm the oil and wine. Don't bother that. That's for the rich people and even us, the conquerors. And so the filthy rich get off. They have plenty of food and what have you. This is for the working people who are losing. losing out because of what they're doing. And there's the pale horse in the Greek. The word is green, so that's why they depicted it with as a green horse here. But I think of the kind of a sickly, pallid, a horse close to death or whatever. I mean, that's the idea because he has death in tow. He has death in tow with Hades just behind him. So where there's death, there's Hades. There's the place of the dead. And so again, that's just summing up everything with them because they were given authority of fourth of the earth, and I think that might be all of these horses, the fourth of the earth. So they were restrained in some way. They couldn't. It wasn't the full number, one quarter of the earth, to kill with sword, with famine, with pestilence, and by wild beasts of the earth. So this is havoc being wreaked by these horses, these riders on horses, throughout the world. It was happening to these people. It was going to happen some more. It was happening now as people are reading this originally. It was going to continue to happen. And it's happened in our time. It's happened historically right down to today. Everything that we're reading here is still going on. All of this havoc is still being wrecked on the earth. And so if you ask, what does this have to do with anything? Well, there are those who conquer. There are wars still going on and has gone on. There are people who are starving all over the earth, and people are dying. There's disease that continues to rage through countries and through people, and is causing all kinds of havoc. So that song we say, sorrows like sea billows roll. This is adversity like this, like sea billows rolling through the earth. And God recognizes this. He sees this. One thing we learn from this chapter is God knows this. These living creatures with their eyes are sending these out, but they know, they see. God understands what's going on. And in fact, and we'll get to this a little bit more later, but he allows it, of course. He allows it to go on. He could stop it, but he doesn't. He allows that to go on. If we should have learned by now, in the last year, what's going on. I mean, just if you look at the pale horse that's bringing pestilence and disease, that's something that we're experiencing in our lifetime. But people in all places in the world and in our country as well have experienced it before at some level. I've never been to a year full of church services like this, and seeing people with masks on—that's new. I mean, that's something new. But disease is something that is real, and it happens all the time. 3 million people died last year. 3 million people in total. That was the largest death toll apparently ever in the United States. 3 million people died in 2020, and some of those were COVID. COVID was the third cause of death. Heart disease and cancer were number one and two. Then COVID. And you know, the usual cause of death, typically in third place, is unintentional injury. I have to read that because I don't know what an intentional injury is. I guess that might be suicide or something, but unintentional injuries. A few years ago, I read that 800 people a week are hurt by their own jewelry. So, you know, who knows? But the point is, whatever the source, adversity strikes. It strikes us, and we have to deal with it. We need to understand it. It's real. So let's talk about that a little bit. Adversity simply means, you know, suffering, bad stuff is what happens to you. If you're suffering some kind of adversity, it means something bad is going on. It sometimes has an adversary, someone who is doing that to you. Sometimes that adversary is impersonal, like a disease. Sometimes it's personal. It's just all of that kind of thing. And we don't want to suffer adversity. We prefer to avoid it. Well, we take steps as much as humanly possible to avoid adversity. That's what we do naturally, of course. I want to kind of make sure we understand that everybody suffers this. There might be a 10-year-old that suffers adversity. That to that person, That's suffering. They're suffering. I mean, need to understand that. Teenagers suffer adversity. The elderly suffer adversity. That's a little more real, and we understand that. But people from all walks of life suffer it. The four horsemen are showing this, are demonstrating this through their actions. The thing that they have in common is that all of this is coming from outside the person. God doesn't deal in this section with the adversity we bring on ourselves. We often bring a lot of stuff on ourselves, and He's not dealing with that here. That's something that we can do, and we often do, but He doesn't deal with that here. We've seen, just looking at each one of these things, we've seen each one of these horses, as I said earlier, or the men on the horses, kind of pictured in our lifetime. I can think of all of the people who tried to conquer. I wrote down some of these people. You know, Hitler is like the poster boy for the one who wants to conquer people and take over everything, take over the world, but far from the only one. There are many before him and many since. Stalin wanted to do the same thing around the same time. In my lifetime, I just wrote down a few of these that popped into my mind. And I was kind of surprised how many there are, but and this isn't even part of the list. I mean, there's a lot more we could talk about, but there's Khrushchev in the USSR, Pol Pot in Cambodia, Ho Chi Minh in North Vietnam, Mao Zedong in China, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, Idi Amin in Uganda, and on and on and on we could go. These are people who go out to conquer, and they want to take over people, and doing that then brings great adversity to that nation or that country or that area they rule. I'm thinking of Robert Mugabe, who is ruling in Zimbabwe. And I remember when Patty Kendall Ball came and talked to us about that during his rule. He lived in a big mansion. I mean, he don't harm the oil and wine. He had plenty of that. He had everything he needed. Meanwhile, if you wanted a loaf of bread, if you could find one, I remember very specifically Patty Kendall Ball talking about this. He had to stuff his clothes with money, with Zimbabwe dollars. I have 150 million Zimbabwe dollar at home. I got it up on my bulletin board. 150 million because inflation was out of whack. So he had to stuff his pockets, every pocket he had, with money to go out and buy a loaf of bread. If they had it. That was real. That was going on, and it's going on today. There are people who are starving in other parts of the world. We're helping someone over in Zimbabwe right now on a monthly basis, the church here is, to feed the people there, because without that help, they wouldn't be fed. My mom used to say, and I didn't understand this. I mean, when I was a kid, my mom would say, when she puts the Brussels sprouts in front of me, she would say, you know, you need to eat your vegetables, you need your food, and eat your Brussels sprouts. She said, there's starving children in somewhere. You probably heard that. You probably used it. There's starving children somewhere. And one time I said, well, send them to the starving children. I don't want the Brussels sprouts. But the point is that I think my dad probably took care of me on that. That's probably why I never said that. But the point is, I mean, that didn't really ring true to me. We seemed to have plenty of food whenever we wanted it and all of that. But that's a real issue. And maybe deep down, all of us are fearful of the famine in our personal lives. I mean, why do we stock up so much? Do you have a freezer in your garage like we do, full of stuff? I don't know how we get anything else in there. But we got a giant refrigerator. My grandmother had an ice box. It's about the size of half of this podium up here. And you put ice underneath. You remember the saying, the ice man cometh? It's because they would bring the block of ice, put the ice in the bottom, and the rest was your space this big for the food that you had. Jesus said, give us in prayer, give us this day our daily bread. And we got it stocked up forever. We don't worry about this, but maybe, then why do we work so hard? Why are we trying to make so much money? Why are we killing ourselves trying to work so hard? COVID put a lot of people out of work. In April of 2020, the unemployment rate in California was 16%. In Nevada, it was 29%. That's scary to be out of work. And that's American trauma, right? I mean, that's stuff we worry about. And some people are just worried about where their next meal's coming from. It's hard to be out of work. It's hard not to earn. When these horsemen come out and they say a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius, when they say that, when you don't have any money, when you are out of money, then it seems like that anything you want to buy is like a day's wage. I mean, it's expensive depending on how much you have, not so much on how much the thing costs. And that's what was happening and what they're talking about here. I remember when I was out of work for a while, 1971, after Dave was born, and I felt that. It seemed like everything cost a day's wage because I wasn't making hardly anything. And it's terrible. It's a terrible feeling. The red horse comes along, and he's the war horse. We talked about some of those people who've caused war. We got the black horse with the famine. We've got the pale horse that brings death with him through pestilence and disease. And nobody's going to escape that, probably. I mean, everybody's had some kind of disease. They've had that kind of adversity and had to deal with it. I decided at some point that I was just a frightened little boy when I was a kid, because there were so many diseases around, and they talked about them all the time, and they didn't use very good marketing techniques in talking about them. I was worried, for example, that I was terrified of stepping on a rusty nail. I bet you, probably some of you don't have any idea what I'm talking about, why that was so terrible, so scary. And the thing is, instead of saying, well, if you step on a rusty nail, you're going to get tetanus, they said something much worse. They said you're going to get lockjaw. Why didn't they just say tetanus? I didn't know what tetanus was, and probably no one would explain it to me. They said lockjaw. So every time I stepped on anything, had any kind of wound at all, I just waited for my jaw to lock up. I just knew it was going to lock up. And that just seemed so terrifying to me, because I thought, well, not only could I not talk, that wasn't the worst part, I couldn't eat. Then you're just going to die. I'm just going to die. And then I got on to botulism. Everything had botulism in it for a while when I was growing up, because they were talking about it. It would come up on the news. It'd be botulism. So my mother probably wondered what happened to a lot of stuff, a lot of her food items that I threw away kind of secretly, because I just knew they had botulism in it. I was just like, I didn't realize I was such a hypochondriac. I couldn't even spell it, but that's what I was. And I think I've grown out of that mostly. Not completely, but I've grown out of that mostly. The point is simple enough, and that is adversity is a real thing. And whatever it is, whether you're involved in any of these, in war or in famine of some kind, much of our country, of course, almost all of it went through a depression in the 30s when the people standing in line to get stuff. It really does happen sometimes. We feel somewhat insulated. We should know better by now because we have dealt with what we've dealt with the last year. But these things are real, and we can't escape it. And we can count on it happening to us. And what I want to say about that is that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. In fact, God is allowing these things. This is what we're seeing here. God is allowing these things. That's obvious to us, or should be. There's some people who will say, well, God shouldn't allow these things. He shouldn't allow all this adversity to happen in our lives. Well, he does it for a reason. He allows it for a reason. Because adversity helps us. Adversity helps us grow. In Romans chapter 5, after talking about our faith, and he says this in verse 1, therefore, since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Through him we also have obtained access by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we rejoice in hope of the glory of God. Not only that, But we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. That gives us a different perspective. If we understand that what he just said, that we rejoice even in trials and sufferings, we realize that those are being poured out on us as they are by these horsemen that are riding out. Those, that adversity is pouring out on us. We also realize that God is pouring out his love into our hearts through the Holy Spirit. So that's all to say that we grow through adversity. And everybody knows that. We complain about it, but we know it. I've never sat in a class, never taught a class when this topic didn't come up. When it came up and somebody said, no, I don't agree that. I don't agree that I learned anything from my past suffering. I've never heard that. In fact, just last night, I was talking to a group of guys. We were all talking. We could talk about anything we wanted to talk about, four or five of us together. And we talked about our close calls. That's what we started talking about. All the close calls we had. You know, that we almost died. And then unsaid thing there was, this is what I learned from that. And we learned from adversity. That's what James says. Count it all joy when you suffer various trials, knowing that it leads to all this good stuff. Makes you steadfast and leads to endurance. So, I had a friend who used to say, actually a guy I worked with, in every adversity there's an equivalent or greater benefit. In every adversity there's a seed of an equivalent or greater benefit. Adversity is where we learn and where we grow. And I would suggest that without it, we wouldn't. This is why parents should not save their children from all adversity. I've heard of helicopter parenting, and lately I've heard of drone parenting. And the idea is, okay, I'm going to make sure that I protect them from every little thing that happens to them. They learn through that. They learn from, as long as it's not a risking life and limb, that's how they learn. So I think we all know that. We know that by personal experience. We suffer adversity. We learn some stuff, maybe some hard lessons, and it's good for us. So I'm going to end with an illustration and a quote. I heard this not too long ago. It's by Dr. Abraham Twersky, who is also a rabbi, happens to be a rabbi, but he talked about lobsters. I don't know. Has anybody heard this before? You've heard of that lobster story? No? Okay. Well, good. The lobster actually isn't, this isn't actually the real lobster. The lobster is inside that shell. Okay, so that's lesson number one. The lobster is actually a squishy, mushy thing that it lives inside that shell. What happens, though, is the lobster grows, the squishy, mushy lobster grows, the shell becomes too small. So he's confined in there. And gets very uncomfortable. So what he does is he finds a place in the rocks to hide from the predatory fish so he doesn't get eaten, and sheds his shell, sheds his shell, and begins to grow a new one. A bigger one. One that accommodates his growth. And he goes through that process several times. He keeps putting... He gets uncomfortable. He's squeezed. And then he goes into the rocks. He grows a new shell. Isn't God great? I mean, just have that figured out and give him that instinct and all. I mean, that's one thing that's really cool about that. But the lesson is that the stimulus, Twersky says, the stimulus for the lobster to be able to grow is that it feels uncomfortable. That's what makes it grow. We grow when we feel uncomfortable and start and take steps to make ourselves more comfortable. He also said this. He said, if the lobsters had doctors, they would never grow, because as soon as the lobster feels uncomfortable, he'd go to the doctor, get a Valium and a Percocet, and he'd feel fine and he'd never grow. So you stay in the shell and he'd feel fine. So you get stuff to make you feel comfortable where you are, you know. But he said that doesn't work for the lobster. He gets out of there. And then there's this quote that Christy and I just heard this last night and just thought it was great. He who learns must suffer. And even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart. And in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God. When we heard that, Christy and I just looked at each other. That pain that cannot forget, drips on our heart. And against our will, we get smarter. Because we don't want to suffer the adversity. But we do. And when we do, we learn from it. And that's important. So, from that profound thought, I go to the end of chapter 6 by way of invitation, just to remember that there's a judgment coming. As I said earlier, this judgment in chapter 6 is not the final judgment, because there's going to be some other things going on. The final judgment that this isn't talking about. This is a penultimate judgment. It's a judgment that is kind of a precursor to what's really going to happen. And just notice that these people are trying to hide themselves in the rocks. And notice that they are hiding or trying to hide from the wrath of the Lamb. We talked before about how odd it is to be led by a Lamb. Now he's talking about the wrath of the Lamb. That's even more strange. But that's what they're hiding from. For the great day of their wrath has come. Who can stand? Heaven, as some folks like to say, is a prepared place for prepared people. If you're not prepared, you need to get prepared. And we're going to give you a chance to do that. If you want to respond to the invitation, if you're subject to that, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.